You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Research studies in the public mind can often be treated as truth and fact simply because they exist. Research data is indeed far more convoluted and often includes mistakes which have wide implications on people's perception and how information is applied. Three academics at the University of Auckland have been involved in uncovering fraudulent research in the field of osteoporosis. I spoke to Associate Professor at University of Auckland, Mark Bolland, about their findings, first asking him why data can be wrong and what its implications are.
The data can be wrong for a whole lot of reasons. That can just be simple things like people make transcription errors when they're copying things from one file to another file, or they can have done the wrong analyses, or sometimes what happens is that people just make genuine mistakes and some of the data that gets entered into their files which they do the analyses on turn out to be incorrect, and that can be for a whole lot of reasons. So that's one level where there's just simple errors that people have made. As you get more serious errors, there's a whole range of things that people can do. So people can plagiarise other people's work, where they just copy exactly what other people have done and make it appear as if it's their own work.
Mm-hmm.
People can write a whole lot of papers on the same data, pretending that it's actually a whole lot of different studies, when really it's just one piece of work that they've end up publishing 20 or 30 different times.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can get even to more significant cases where there's actual clear misconduct, where people make up data, or that they may have their data that's already there but they just tweak it so it is more consistent with the results that they want to achieve. There's a whole range of things, from honest errors through to obvious misconduct.
Right. And so tell me a bit about the meta-analysis and the research, the uncovering of fraudulent data that you have been involved in.
Okay, about 5 years ago, I was having a conversation with one of my colleagues about some reviews that had used pretty unusual methods to come up with their answers. And she asked me what I knew about a particular group from Japan who carried out a lot of clinical trials in the area of osteoporosis, which is where I research in.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really know too much about them, but I looked up some of their papers, and immediately, as soon as you look at any of their papers, a whole lot of red flags jumped out at you, as there's obvious errors and there's a whole lot of other concerning things about their papers as well. And so we had further conversations and decided that we should do a formal review of all of their work to see whether these errors were just one-off things in some papers or it was more of a systematic problem.
Mm. And what are some of those red flags that you saw?
Oh, a whole range of things, actually. From simple things like all clinical trials should have approval from an ethics committee, and a number of the trials didn't. It wasn't reported in the publication.
Mm.
Likewise, trials are expensive to run, and so there's almost always a funding statement in them, and none of the trials had any funding statements. So there were some simple things like that. But two more concerning things were that the group published 33 clinical trials over about a 15-year time period, which is astonishingly hard to do.
Mm.
It's incredibly productive. And lots of those trials were pretty implausible. So in a couple of the trials, they recruited a really large number of elderly people who were quite frail and who had a lot of health conditions. And they apparently recruited them in over a period of 2 or 3 months to their trial, and then followed them up every month for the next 2 years or so. But even though these people were quite elderly and had very frail with lots of health conditions, hardly any of them passed away during the trials, and hardly any of them seemed to have any problems during the trials as well. So that was another sort of thing. Another aspect that we were worried about was that in every trial they always got really positive results. So they often looked at hip fractures and showed that whatever agent that they were studying produced about an 80% reduction in hip fractures. And we know from other research that that's almost impossible. The best things that we can do to prevent hip fractures might prevent about half of them. But anything that these guys tried was much more effective than that. So there were a whole lot of concerns like that. But we thought that people would want more harder or objective evidence that there were problems with these studies rather than just accepting all this sort of circumstantial stuff. So I did a whole lot of statistical analyses, essentially looking at the characteristics of people that were included into the trial. When you start off in a trial, you get randomly allocated, so allocated by chance to one treatment group or another. And because of that, all the characteristics of people when they enter the trial should be randomly distributed.
Yeah.
But that didn't really happen in this group. So say, for example, if you're looking at the age of people in one treatment group versus another, and you're looking at that across all the trials, there should be a random distribution of the results. But what we found is that the results were much more similar than you'd expect if true randomisation had have taken place.
Yeah, so there's a real lack of variability within the participants of the study.
Yeah, and that comes about just because it's hard as a human to generate a random number. It's almost impossible. And so whenever anybody tries to do it, they generally fail unless you use a computer.
Right.
That was one of the most important things that we found with the trial.
Wow. So this information that was produced, I read that it was referenced quite a lot, so it kind of, it obviously influences, it has wider implications, but what sort of things has this data influenced?
So the researchers chose quite a niche area to research in. So they were looking in osteoporosis, but more specifically in patients with neurological conditions who might have osteoporosis. So it's quite a really narrow focus. And there weren't many other trials in that field, in that particular aspect of it. So that almost all of the evidence about treating patients with neurological conditions who might have osteoporosis came from these researchers. So anybody who did a systematic review and tried to gather all the evidence that was available included all these trials. But also a lot of people thought that these results were really impressive, so that they felt that they should go and do clinical trials that were either in the same area or related to it. So a number of research groups did quite large, expensive trials on people, which turned out to have no effect of the agent, but because they believed the results of this research group.
So what's the purpose behind the fraud? What are the researchers, other than being published, which is something which is valuable in the academic world, is there another purpose behind it?
In this case, it's really hard to know. I think you're right more generally. The most common reason for people doing fraud is because they want the academic prestige that comes from publishing lots of papers. In the academic world, there's a phrase called publish or perish.
Yes.
Where there's intense pressure upon people who are academics to publish a lot of papers, and particularly papers in high-impact journals. And so there's, in lots of cases of fraud, it's been done for that particular reason.
Right. So it continues the generation of funding and resources, I guess, things like that.
Yeah, and also it allows people, often these people become get a very good reputation, and that they travel the world talking about their results. And this particular case, it's quite different, though, I think, in that the main person involved was a doctor in a small hospital in a fairly provincial town who wasn't linked to the world of academia. So it's really unclear what his motive was.
Mm-hmm.
And some people have suggested it was almost like a hobby, or perhaps where he did it a couple of times and enjoyed it so much that he may have continued to do it because he got such good results from it. But that's all speculation. Nobody really knows.
Yeah, I read there's an article in the Science Journal with your colleague who's from Aberdeen University, and she talks about the elusiveness of the researcher, and I just find that really interesting as well.
Yeah, it's been a really difficult case to be involved with because he doesn't have, the main researcher doesn't have a large academic institution. It's been difficult to get people to investigate. It's usually the university that the possible fraudster is linked to will do an investigation, but that wasn't the case in this situation.
So now that it has been uncovered, how has this changed things in osteoporosis?
Well, essentially we've gone from having a group of trials that were published by this group, which showed there were a whole lot of treatments that people with neurological diseases and osteoporosis could use. We've gone from that situation to having no evidence about what we should do.
Kind of at square one again.
Yeah, so it's taken us back. But also a lot of people, I think, have gone down wrong pathways because of this research. And so it's going to take several years, I think, before all the consequences of the fraud flow through and we start getting well-conducted research again.
So around, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire. That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.